Welcome, Jen. Thank you very much. Jen is the Executive Vice President of Privacy for Kimball & Associates and a partner within that firm. She's also the Chief Privacy Officer of Verato. Focuses on supporting organizations in transition from compliance to commitment in privacy excellence in identity management. She's involved with multiple NSTIC pilots and is an IDESG plenary chair. Welcome, Jen, and we're most interested to hear what you have to say about privacy. If you'd like, we could ask folks to hold their questions until the end of what you have to say, and we'll ask them, get them to ask at that point.
Okay, thanks. Thank you for the introduction and the welcome. And either way, I'm completely comfortable if people want to jump in and ask questions as I go. I put together some thoughts about my experience in implementing privacy practices in identity management, as well as just some general aspects of privacy that are good from a practical implementation standpoint, but certainly welcome questions that are more focused around what you all are looking for. And so with that, again, I'm fine either way if you all want to pull questions or ping me as they come up. And so as my introduction went over a little bit, I do have most experience in the privacy arena working with companies or consortiums that are looking at implementing identity management system and working with significant amounts of identity information. Some of these organizations have a privacy program that's in place that they need to expand or evolve, and some have no privacy considerations that have been established or stood up or have thought to be relevant. And so really have enjoyed working kind of with the gamut on that. I'll say that if you're looking at establishing a strong identity management framework or a program, one of the main aspects of developing and implementing your privacy is to really have a thoughtful consideration as to what type of privacy governance framework do you want to work with. Often identifying your framework will lead you to what types of policies you want to generate and the practices that you need to instill. And once you get your privacy governance structure determined, then you can start applying that against the practices. With identity assurance, you're going to have significant and vast amounts of personally identifiable information, if not PHI, depending upon the systems that you're working in. So when you're considering your privacy, as opposed to an organization that might just be an online retail or a company such as that, if you're really looking at identity, you need to be very careful and walking through and applying your privacy governance structure against the practices that are specific to identity management around collection, really your processing, your storage, your transmission, and your disposal. So the collection, oftentimes I've seen organizations get tripped up and use the consent mechanism as a get-out-of-jail-free card with identity and think that that covers all aspects of privacy. If I get someone to consent to give me their identifying information so that I can proof them, then that gives me, that covers everything. And it's really not applicable in all situations. And specifically in healthcare, there's a big difference between consent and authorization, which I'm sure you all are aware of. And authorization is a huge tool that you can invoke when you're looking at maintaining privacy with identity assurance and management programs. And so really walking through very carefully your sequence diagrams, and articulating where you have your data journeys originating from and ending and all the processing and hosting that's going on in any transmission. Really looking at how to minimize the use of claims, attribute sets and focus on claim sets. as well as just minimizing the amount of information that you need to hang on to. Once you've used that information, do you need to keep it any further? Is there a justifiable business reason other than we might be preventing fraud at some later date, which is it's a very loose business case. And so you want to make sure that you have all those things really tied up and assessed really well in an identity management framework, because those are the sorts of things that can get tricky down the road if you have an incident later. If you haven't been able to establish the sequence diagrams with the flows of the data journey, and then you don't understand what's being processed and what has to be processed, you can get tripped up by that later. That leads us into a really strong aspect of what you need to walk through with your, if you're developing an identity management or assurance program, is to apply a structured risk assessment. There are a few out there. There are a growing number of risk assessment frameworks out there. But what this does is you are able to actually dig down in deep to see, again, where your individual data risks are, or the single instances that may cause problems with, for example, that consent that you may have collected. If you're transmitting identity information to a back-end vendor that no one's aware of in that consent mechanism, then you could get in some trouble. But walking through a strong risk assessment framework, breaking all those data actions down, you can quickly identify those, and then you can determine if you need to implement various privacy and security controls. This also helps the business side articulate how they're keeping their system private and secure. This is a very classic example of working with my work with engineers and developers as they're putting together a program. And we're developing, you know, a framework, governance structure for the whole identity program, and looking at the technical aspects of that, and then needing to come in and break it down and really figure out and assure the privacy. What you'll get initially kickback is, well, it's private. We know it's private. We use a PETP, so we know it's private, and you don't need to worry about it. Well, that doesn't quite get you there, and so you will have to dig. But this gets you back to your governance structure also. Once you do your risk management framework, then you can start identifying those security and privacy controls that either need to be advanced or evolved or altered in any way that you have looked at your privacy risk. And then when you're looking at your overall governance structure, you are then able to really make sure that your business, legal, and technical aspects of that governance structure include the privacy aspects that everyone in the organization or consortium can abide by. And so if you know that, you know, you've looked at some of the aspects of your system or the organizations who are going to be playing in your consortium or group, and you know that there is a lot of data handling as far as transmitting back and forth, then you are going to need to know how to set up that governance structure in your business and your legal aspects to protect those sorts of things, especially around topics such as liability and who has jurisdiction over what information when. And all of those things can be touched upon by privacy assessments as well. And, you know, when you're looking at building out a strong privacy program with identity management, the other aspects that I have found that are you need to consistently apply that will then help alleviate your legal implications and legal risk that satisfy many of the privacy tenets are making sure that you have a highly transparent system. This goes to the difference between doing a blanket consent mechanism that you invoke on the first screen versus doing just-in-time or real-time authorization mechanisms. The other critical aspect that is it's a different different methodology than privacy, but it's closely linked. And for assessing and working with identity management, it's critical, and that's the discipline of user experience. And so making sure that you have a very user-centric approach to developing your identity management system or program or identity assurance program, the focus, you should be focused on increasing the user centricity of your model, which will then work well to mitigate privacy risk, because a lot of the control of the information is maintained by that end user, or the awareness of what's going on in the background. That user is aware of and has made deliberate choices about what's happening with their identity information within the systems, and can and has meaningful information about consequences if they don't want to give up information, or the handling and passage of their attributes between systems. And so they are fully informed at a level that is not uber or legalese. It's very user-centric again. And so those would be the things that, you know, if I was opening into walking into a identity assurance or identity management program, that I would immediately come to the table with, thinking I need to look, figure out what governance program they're operating under, what sort of risk management program are they going to be implementing, and a structured approach, and then how are we focusing on the transparency and user centricity to strengthen the privacy posture for the end user, while also incorporating those aspects of that information you know about the system for the business legal and technical side of the governance of the entire program. And so that's my overview. And I can certainly take questions, answer more, expand on points.
Well, while everybody's gathering their questions, I'll go ahead and start with just a clarifying question. You mentioned the distinction between attribute sets and claim sets.
Sure.
Is that like storing, you know, user number 2000 is above 21 years of age, but we don't need to record their exact date of birth, that sort of thing?
That's exactly right. Okay. It can even go further, and so that you go through the proofing experience, you know, episode, and so you have proofed that person. You know, there's some organizations, and this can go either way. But if you are really looking at moving to very strict claim sets, you know, if you proof someone with their social security number, the likelihood of their social security number is not of changing is not very high. And so if you have provided some sort of proofing mechanism that you have verified that and authenticated it already, looking at is there a reason, a business reason, to keep that social security number, or can you dispose of it because you don't need that attribute anymore? So those are the types of conversations that should be held when you're looking at reducing the amount of attributes you maintain in your system once you have done the identity assurance work that you need to accomplish.
So, Jen?
Yes.
It's Richard Wilshire. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine, but I'm going to ruin your life with a question. So, what you just said is all well and good from a purely business perspective, where, you know, information is a liability, so the quicker you dump it, the better. But the other side of the coin is that there are many legal requirements to hold information, not because it's of any real value after the event, except in the case that there's any legal challenge, then of course you might need to prove that you did actually apply due diligence, and the only way you can do that is by retaining a lot of stuff which is PII, and you really wouldn't rather have that for that defensive purpose.
Sure. So you're absolutely right, and perhaps I rolled up in my head and did not delineate. If you're looking at your business case, also consider the legal ramifications of what information you do need to keep for auditing, or if you're in, you know, identity proofing to prevent fraud, if you need to keep any of that information. And you're right, and I appreciate the opportunity to expand. So some of it is about what do you keep? Do you keep attributes or claims? And then the other side of that is when you're looking at the difference between attributes and claims, you also should look at what are you passing. Do you need to pass the whole attribute set, or do you need to pass the claim set? And so getting back to Scott's original example of, do I need to pass the birth date of this person downstream to the next entity in the flow, or is all they need that this user is above the age of 21? And so then can I do some processing and get the attributes into a claim that this user is yes or no above 21 and pass that information instead of the attribute set? And then that prevents the bleed of pie between organizations as well. So yes, different ways of looking at it.
Thanks.
What about when this is Russ Weiser?
Hello.
When government requires me to pass highly sensitive data, such as Social Security and date of birth, as verified attributes, and you know, it's there could be other alternatives, such as a hash of the Social Security number is retained, and that's all that's retained.
That's a good point, Russ. Sorry to jump in front of your answer, Jen, but when Richard was saying the only way to prove that you knew sensitive PII is to store that PII, that's one way to prove it, but there are other ways, like storing a hash, you can later, with the same social, prove that you knew the social then. So,
right.
Sorry to interrupt, but I think that's a good point. I want to agree.
And that's one of the things we ran into with Connect.gov and the government agencies. Well, we want to match up your Social Security number with what we have in our database. So they require us to pass it, which requires all sorts of headaches with the storage of that information. Have you run into cases where relying applications or relying parties could deal with the hash as a mechanism instead of passing the actual value?
So in my experience right now, so organizations are becoming more familiar with that capability. It does require a little bit more hand-holding to figure it out in negotiation of who's going to kind of drive it. And so it's I think, becoming a more frequent tool to use. It's not, I don't think it's pervasive at this point, and people are still trying to figure out how they can use it.
Okay. This is Ken, Jen. I was very interested in your look at three things that, you know, what is the governance framework they're following, what risk management process are they following, and then are they focused on the user experience? Could you delve into those three a little more? What I'm interested in looking for is, what are the characteristics of an organization that is following good privacy-respecting private practices?
That question seems a little bit more general than just to identity. So I can take, because I certainly work with agencies in developing privacy part.
Okay, focus just on the identity side of it.
Okay, well, and I mean, really, so your governance is going to be your backbone. It's going to give you the rules of the road for what are your legislative requirements that you have to comply with, any industry standards that you have to comply with, how you have oversight over compliance with those sorts of things, how you make organizational decisions and innovate those practices. And so you're going to really use your governance, again, as your backbone. Then you're going to start applying policies and assessing policies with the practices that you all utilize and live on a, you know, how you implement and drive your business. And those policies, again, are going to be able to support and uphold the governance structure that you've developed, you know, everything from your, you know, a really mature governance structure, privacy governance structure has a charter and a vision and a mission, which should feed into the organizational governance structure, and as well as your statutes and your regulations and standards. And so you're going to base your policies over that, as well as what good privacy handling practices are around collection, processing, storage, and those sorts of things as well. So you can have your industry and regulatory scoped policies and practices that also envelop data handling, coding, logging and monitoring, auditing, review cycles of various aspects, you know, your user access, your physical access, all of those sorts of things. You're going to want to have policies about that, password protection, all of those. So you're going to want to have a very comprehensive set of policies. Your governance structure is going to help you determine how you're assessing your compliance with those. Again, what sort of review cycles do you all have? Who has oversight? Who are the stakeholders that are involved? All of those sorts of aspects go into a good privacy governance structure. You're going to want to, as part of a comprehensive privacy program, have a, you would like to have a fairly robust asset inventory that includes what data do you all collect at different points, how long do you store it, where do you store it, and then also have an assessment process to look at the level of threat and vulnerabilities to those assets and to that data. And this can be anything from software to hardware. You know, I've recently done one for an identity company, and you know, we were doing an exceptionally comprehensive asset inventory, looking at everything from all of the laptops to the shredders to the copiers to AWS and to Outlook 365 and the cable company that they had. So you're looking at all the assets, but then in addition to assessing the threats and vulnerabilities, look at what the value of those assets are. And so if your shredders are valued at a 1 and your software or your source code is valued at a 10, you obviously know where you want to have more focused approach, not only to assessing your risk in a very deliberate manner, but then also protecting it. So this feeds back into the legal side of things, looking at what how you want to structure liability, you want to structure your legal contracts about IP, but then you also want to look at your cyber insurance policies and how all of those are enveloped in that, and they're related. In addition to your data assets, you want to really wrap in a comprehensive training and awareness program that's focused not only on security, but also envelops that privacy awareness. And you can conjoin the two. They are very interrelated and core to one another. So you know, you don't want to bombard your organization and have your developers spending half their week doing privacy, but having some sort of regular routine schedule, and then doing performance tracking on that as well, and compliance. There are an increasing amount of regulatory standards or regulatory requirements around training, in addition to you have industry standards around training, and certainly contractual obligations that are, you have training. You can be pushed into scope of an industry very easily that you aren't didn't anticipate if you were contractually obligated. And so being very aware of what goes on in your contracts, again, having that legal interplay with the privacy to know even what trainings that you're obligated to do. And then I would say the last really big bucket when I look at a privacy framework, and this is certainly very important for an identity assurance project or program, would be what level of data breach preparedness do you all have? And walking through the different aspects of that, this will get very much back to your asset inventory, any legal and cyber insurance information that you have, what sort of review cycles you've been doing so you can make sure what was covered when, and all those sorts of things.
Jen, does time allow you to keep taking questions, or are we up?
I can keep taking questions. I'm not sure the amount of time.
Well, we had originally booked half an hour, but if you have more time there are more questions, I'd personally really appreciate it if you could continue answering.
Sure. Absolutely.
Was that Jamie that asked that question?
It is. Ken, this is Jamie Clark. I'm from Oasis. I'm here by invitation from Ken because he was good enough to come to the Kantar Assurance Review Board and say, you guys really ought to come listen to Jen. So here we are. In wearing other hats, I'm aware of, and we even host, a number of privacy standards projects to create methodologies and frameworks and analyses to perform some of those things. And I have to say, Jen, I'm curious about your perception about the maturity of those frameworks, because before the last year or so of big privacy pogroms where folks are trying to get their act together, I have to say our guys were out there looking high and low for what you described as mature privacy frameworks in industry or government. And I have to say, the number has been lower than one might hope, and particularly in government. My God, I want a refund on my taxes. I mean, very little. Now, is it you just said, okay, here's what you do if you have mature privacy framework. So does that mean there are more entities out there today that, you know, if you stick your mature privacy framework thermometer into some of these companies, what are you getting in the field? Do we have some reason to be more confident than we once were?
So it's interesting. I think that you're right. There, certainly in the United States, we don't have an overarching privacy framework. We have various industries or sectors that have their own privacy frameworks. There's a great deal of overlap between the two, industry and sector. And what I have seen organizations do, however, is to often, what's happening in my experience more often these days is that organizations will want to go out and get assessed in third-party certification programs and essentially cover as many bases as they can. And if that means multiple certification programs, then they will do that. The certification programs, they range in how much they cover in privacy. They tend to be more security-focused, the controls-based. They're increasingly incorporating privacy aspects. now, those are different those are different than risk frameworks. And I would definitely say that as far as privacy risk frameworks, we are in the infancy or maybe toddler stage of privacy frameworks. There have been privacy risk frameworks. Has been some great work done in the last couple of years to try and put out there on the street some ways to utilize some sort of metric around assessing risk with privacy and breaking it down. It was challenging, I can say even 3 years ago, it was challenging to use a privacy framework as a guideline for doing a risk assessment in privacy. And I did that for about 6 to 9 months with one company trying to do a risk assessment, privacy risk assessment with their identity platform that they were building and measuring it against the Fair Information Practice Principles, which was the privacy framework to which that consortium was subscribing. And it's hard to assess risk on qualitative statements about you must have purpose specification. And so that's hard to assess risk against that sort of thing. So yeah, that's a long rambling way, Jamie, of saying yes, I agree with you. I think there has been movement. The CRAM from NIST, I think, is a useful tool. I think there are things that you can either use the CRAM in its entirety, or you can take aspects of it and apply it. I think that certainly I would be remiss if I didn't call out the IDEF and providing a very comprehensive set of standards across multiple disciplines looking at identity information. So there are some growing ways to measure it. But again, in my experience, in the last couple years, companies are bringing a very multifaceted approach to assessing privacy. Because there hasn't been one bright, shiny way to do it.
Jen, you prefaced that last set of remarks, which I found most interesting, by in the U.S. Are you aware of any outside of the U.S.?
So I'm not as familiar with international privacy, having focused most of my time in domestic privacy. Europe seems to have a much more advanced privacy approach. That said, with the GDPR of late, it's been an interesting place for me to observe. Again, I do not have significant experience with the international aspects of privacy, as far as a working experience. In my previous few years, in my interactions with people who work in international privacy, it was hands down, Europe is much more advanced than the United States. But then the GDPR issues started coming around, and it seemed like everyone got really nervous and didn't quite know what they were going to do. And I'll say I attended a workshop a month ago on that, and it was interesting because there were a lot of articulations about what would be coming out or what would be new in the GDPR, but no one really understood how to apply it yet. So it was the information was not, no one knew how to operationalize it yet. So I think the next 6 months will be very interesting in that regard. I will say that privacy by design certainly has a very strong backbone and a committed following, and is gets a lot of people very excited and really starting to propel, I think, more C-suites which has been very exciting, into thinking about, oh, we need to think of privacy not as a bolt-on or as a reactive measure to we got breached or someone's laptop got stolen, but we actually need to start thinking about this cradle to grave. And privacy by design, I think, has been a really good vehicle to help executives understand what that looks like. I know I've seen it in referenced in proposals and work streams that organizations come out and they, you know, they want to avoid incidents, or they have key stakeholders, board members or such, that have experience with outside experience with data breaches and such. And so they'll often put out, we want privacy by design. How do we get privacy by design now? So it's not necessarily something that provides them the rules of how they actually dig down and implement privacy within their program as far as a in-depth application, but it gets them excited to know that, you know, you should embed privacy in the policy and technology. And you can start it at the beginning and not just as a bolt-on, and the transparency side of it. So it really, I think, it has provided a very meaningful vehicle for that sort of thought process and getting the ball rolling.
Jen, are you at all familiar with international standardization work in this field?
As far as?
As far as privacy standardization and developments in that area, the particular reason I mention it is that I think what you've just been saying is basically get it right first time rather than try and append it later. One of the things that I'm very involved in is the development of ISO 27001, which is an information security management system standard. And one of the things which I think at the moment is in a study period is looking at providing a profile of that standard. It would be a way to apply the information security management system standard in a privacy domain. And that may be something you'd be interested in participating in, either at the national level or maybe international level. And I can give you some details if you wish.
Yeah, I think that's very exciting. I know, so I just formally started as the plenary chair for IDSG, but in my former work with them, I was the privacy committee chair. And one of the things that we were starting to look at was applying profiles to such different frameworks and controls. So that would be very exciting. So I would definitely appreciate if you would pass that information along.
I'll send you an email.
Great.
Any other questions for Jen?
The reading list would be helpful. You have a couple of good references.
Sure, I do. I can send that.
You just send it out to the... That would be useful.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you could provide that to Scott, then Scott could distribute it to the group. That would be wonderful.
Absolutely.
Any other questions for Jen?
There's a question in the chat.
Cool. I'm gonna open.
Should we read it for the...
Okay, working on a consent record audit specification for providing consent receipts with controls to manage consent by purpose. This is from Mark Lazar. Do you think this type of human-centric toolset could be a valid way to mitigate risk of using an identity assurance framework?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because it was, I think about a year and a half ago, I had that conversation about consent receipts with Mary Hodder, who's a user experience expert. And so we both got very excited about it. and I know that there have been some really good good efforts with different consent platforms that actually maintain a record of consent that can be audited and logged. And so I want to say Denise Taylor with Privo has done one, and I know Ken Klingenstein has definitely been working on one, but that those consent receipts are definitely, it's a very, very exciting nuance into consent, right? And that if the humans and the users could actually maintain that or have access to that, that downstream applicability of their consent, well, that would be very exciting from a privacy side of things. That kind of blows my mind.
Well, there's a group within Kantara, Consent Information Sharing Group, that Mark Lazar is chairing, that is working on that very topic and that very challenge. So if you might want to get hold of Mark, he is on the call today listening, but his mic isn't working, so he's unable to chat further.
Okay. Yeah. Oh,
actually, Mary Hodder is chairing. My apologies.
Mary, I think it was a year and a half ago we had that initial, maybe 2 years ago we had that conversation.
Yeah, it was actually in reference to, so the User Experience Committee in IDESG had a requirement, which is now a best practice, where if the best practice is to generate a consent receipt when consent is given, we recommend it. But because the CISWG group in Kantara isn't, we're not quite finished with the spec. The idea is finish the spec, get that out, have IDESG approve it as a specification that can be used, and then at that point it becomes a requirement that that entities who want to comply with the IDESG certification would then generate consent receipts. So it's in the works.
Mary.
Thank you, Mary. Any other questions for Jen? Hearing none and seeing none on the chat window. Jen, thank you very, very much for the time you spent with us this afternoon. I found it fascinating to listen to your characteristics of an organization that would have good privacy handling, and to also know that it's in its infancy. I like the idea of the privacy risk framework. I know I was with the Government of Canada for many years, and we were involved in doing some of these assessments and trying to develop a privacy risk framework at that point. So it's interesting, and I think will be very fruitful work when we get one in place that can be actually assessed. So thank you very, very much for your time.